Crime novelist Adrian McKenty is best known for his Sean Duffy series of thrillers set in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. With The Chin, Adrian publishes a standalone thriller described as a deeply unsettling story about the limits of morality. And that was the New York Times that said that. And writer Adrian McKenty is with me now. Very glad that I can say writer Adrian McKenty is with me now, because in fact, about 18 months ago maybe, I'd have been saying Uber driver or
I was exactly. I was writing the Sean Duffy books, and they were getting well reviewed, and they were actually winning a few awards here and there. But nobody was really buying them outside of Northern Ireland, to be honest. And it had just been diminishing returns for 3 or 4 years. And a couple of years ago, I just decided to jack it all in and look after the family. And I got myself a job in a bar, and I got myself driving an Uber, which my wife always thought was ridiculous, because I learned to drive in Larne in rural County Antrim, where there's no other cars on the roads ever. And so when I was driving an Uber through Melbourne, like, I was driving it 15 miles an hour while everybody behind me is honking, and I'm just going, I've got a passenger, I'm responsible, I have to go very slowly here. The passenger's going, I don't know if this guy knows what he's doing at all here. I got horrible Uber ratings, took me 4 hours to get to the airport. So this guy's a joke.
You weren't getting the reviews on Uber that you were getting
on
the books.
No, it's funny that. But I was making more money in Uber than I'd made on the books. I think sympathy money.
Yeah, and it's okay. And I'm sure you can laugh at it now, and it's funny in hindsight. But that must have been incredibly frustrating, because, it is fair to say the Sean Duffy thrillers and other books had won you really big awards. You'd always received critical acclaim. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I spoke to you a number of times about different projects, and I, my innocence would have presumed, well, Adrian McKenty's doing okay. He mightn't be a multi-millionaire, but he's making a living out of this.
And I was really, I felt like I was living this double life in a lot of ways, because I would get invited to these literary conferences and stuff, and I'd be up there on stage with Val McDermott and Ian Rankin, and they'd say, and now Edgar Award winner Adrian McKenty, and big round of applause. But the fact was, just no one was really buying the books. It was a tough sell, because it was like 1980s Belfast, and no one in England really wanted to go back into that world, and no one in America really understood that world. So it was a very tough sell. And so it was, I would always go up and do a reading in No Alibis and Belfast, and I'd be treated like a folk hero, and I'd sell like 200 copies, and then I'd get my royalty statement for the end of the year, and I would have sold like 220 copies in the whole world. I think, oh my goodness.
And the motivation to get to the desk then on a daily basis.
It wasn't so much that, it was just I felt so guilty. My wife was working as a teacher full time, and she was bringing and all the money.
And you had been a teacher.
And I had been a school teacher until I decided to go full-time as a writer. And I just thought, this is absurd. I'm bringing in nothing. And things just came to a head about 2 years ago. And for one reason or another, we ended up being evicted from our house. And I remember they put all your stuff out on the pavement in front of your house. And I remember my wee daughter, Sophie, just looking at me and saying, is everything going to be all right, Daddy? And I said, of course it is. Of course it is, darling. And meanwhile, inside, I'm thinking, look, is everything going to be all right?
I mean, was in Melbourne.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, I don't know if everything's going to be all right. And so then I just thought to myself, Adrian, you have been living this lie this last 5 years of this writerly, existence, often this typical male ego trip, while your wife is doing all the hard work at the family here. So I just went down to the job centre the very next day, got a job in a bar and registered as an Uber driver. And I just decided done.
We'll leave it at that. Now, you said about being at conferences with Ian Rankin, who I see has a little dedication or a quote here in The Chin. Val McDermott is there too. But the very first quote in this book is from Don Winslow, crime writer, very successful crime writer. He kind of was instrumental in The Chin coming into existence.
He really was. I was done. I'd quit about a month, and I did a blog post saying, look, I'm done as a writer. And I didn't want people to worry, because I'd been blogging all the time and doing book reviews all the time, and I was taking a break from all that. So I just did a blog post. Look, I'm taking a maybe 1 or 2 year break from writing. I'm done. And then Winslow calls me up in the middle of the night and says...
How big a surprise was it?
It was a huge surprise.
It's Don Winslow here.
It was an enormous surprise because I'd met him once about 4 years earlier for 5 minutes at a VoucherCon. So I had no idea that he'd heard of me at all. But apparently he had. And so he calls me up out of the blue and says, Adrian, what's all this? I was looking forward to your next book. And I was going, like, I didn't even know you knew who I was. And I explained the situation. And then he said, you need an agent who will fight for you. And I'll give my books to my best friend, this guy called Shane Salerno. And I said, give them to you, whoever you like.
And was Salerno a name you recognised?
I'd never heard of him before.
Is he a big deal? Well, he is a big deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, so what happened was about 2 weeks later, I mean, I forgot all about the Winslow phone call, and I'd had a terrible day. And about 12:30 at night, I get this phone call. You know, it says, hi there, I'm calling from Hollywood, California. I'm Shane Salerno. And I just go, oh my God, who's this?
Here's somebody from Hollywood, County Down, winding me up.
Yeah, I thought, who's this guy? And so he's talking away to me for about 5 minutes about how he's Don Winslow's agent. And I'm so tired and I'm done with all this business. So I just hung up on him. And I guess not many people hang up on this guy.
But was this before or after? Because I think he did say to you, you know, you got to write something. And not only that, what if I said to you, I'll wire $10,000?
Yeah. So that,
$10,000 into your bank account tonight.
That happened in that conversation. He said to me, what is the stumbling block that's preventing you from writing? And I said to him, well, we've no money. I've got two full-time jobs. I'm looking for more. And he said, all right, I really respect your talent. I want to see what you're doing next. I'll wire $10,000 into your bank account tonight. And I said, I can't take $10,000. I have no idea who you are.
And I want your bank account number. And you think, here comes the scam.
Yeah. And he said, Google me. And I said, I'm not Googling you. And then I turned away to him. And I said, well, what? I said, I can't take charity. And he said, oh, no, I don't do charity. And he said, I'll give you a book for the next book that's in your head. I just want to see it. And so I'll give you this will be an advance on your advance, and so I said, so he said, do you have an American story in you? And I'd been thinking about this story, The Chain, for about 5 or 6 years.
In fact, the Chain is about kidnapping.
Yes.
And it's about if your child is kidnapped, the way you get your child released is you kidnap another child.
Yeah, and pay the
ransom.
And
when that child gets another child, then your child's released. So there's quite a few links in the chain have to be connected.
Yeah, I just thought about this. I thought about these chain letters from you know, Belfast in the 70s. We get these.
This is a teacher of yours back in 1970, Carrick Fergus, who was a very brave woman, a very strong woman to do what she did.
Yeah, I mean, we got these terrifying chain letters. They scared me witless, these letters.
What age were you at that time?
I was about 10 or 9 or 10. And then this teacher we got called Mrs. Carlisle, she took all the chain letters and burned all the letters and destroyed the chain. And so I pitched this idea to Shane. How about there's a chain kidnapping scheme and there's this one heroic woman who breaks the chain?
Yeah, and that's the characters that we get to meet to meet in this chain. But you know, the idea that the chain letter thing, how many years are we on now? The 1970s were what, 40 years ago. You know, that was still so strong. That must have been a very impressive, or whatever, a moment that had a huge impression on you back then.
Yeah. Oh my God. When this Mrs. Carlisle took the letters and burned them all in this bonfire in front of the class, and she said, "I'll take all the hexes and all the bad luck, and I'll take it all on to me." And so we just automatically assumed we'd never see her again because, you know, where they'd say, you know, bad luck, your mother will die if you don't. And we just thought, well, that's the end of her. We'll never see her again. Substitute teacher tomorrow. And I just assumed she would die in a horrific death. In fact, for the next 40 years, every time I go back to Belfast, I'd say to my mum, so how's, you know, my Auntie Agnes doing? How's my cousin Bill? And then at the end of the conversation, how's Mrs. Carlisle doing? You know, expecting to hear, oh my God, you wouldn't believe flesh-eating virus in Carrick Fergus. And in fact, she's 88 years old, completely healthy, completely fine.
All right, so that's her part in all of this. Let's go back. We're still on the phone.
Yeah.
It must be very late at this stage. 12:30, you've hung up on him.
Yeah.
At what point does the conversation move into... Who you're thinking, well, you know, maybe I can do something with this kidnapping mixed with chain letters in Carrickfergus. I can do something with that. When does that Salerno conversation move on?
So I'm pitching him this novel. I said a woman's driving to her oncologist in Boston and she gets this phone call from a frantic stranger who's kidnapped her daughter and said the only way you get your daughter back is if you kidnap someone else and pay the ransom and continue this chain. So I pitched this story to Shane and Shane goes, oh my God, I love that story. Send me chapter one. And I go, there's no chapter one, mate. There's nothing. And he says, well, just send me the outline. He says, there's no outline. And I said, what have you got? And I said, nothing. It's just in my head. And he says, oh, my God, what are you doing right now? And I go, nothing. And he goes, oh, well, just write me chapter one. And he's a very persuasive man. So I find myself at 2:30 in the morning writing the first 30 pages of the chain.
And did it come easily?
Well, it did actually, because I'd clearly been thinking about it for years, and I hadn't written anything for over a year, and so clearly something was pent up, and it all came pouring out. And so I wrote the first 30 pages, sent it off to him by email, and then went upstairs to my wife. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and my wife Leah's in bed. She goes, "What was all that shouting about?" You know, and so
it was a shouty phone call.
Oh yeah, it was quite a shouty phone call because I'd kept telling to leave me alone, and she said, "What was all that shouting about?" And I was going, oh, there's this mad American agent in California. He wants to run. He sort of bullied me into writing this book, blah, blah, blah. And I wrote him 30 pages. She's going, what? What is it? I says, he's going to send us $10,000. And she's going, what are you talking about? What's happened? You know, think I'm on the phone to a Nigerian prince and who needs some money. And then the phone goes at like 4:15. And of course, it's Shane again.
4:15 in the morning.
Yes. And he goes, oh my God, Adrian, those 30 pages, I just read them. We just need 300 more exactly like it. And I'm just going, oh my God. And he goes, Adrian, what time is it there? And I go, it's 4:15 in the morning. He says, oh wow, that's late. You should go to bed. You have a book to write. And he hangs up on me.
How quickly did he ring back to tell you that not only the book that you hadn't written was going to become a film, but that it was going to become a film with quite a substantial forwarding amount to you?
Well, you know, the first huge shock was, we found a publisher. That was a huge shock because I'd been dropped by all my publishers. The second huge shock was when they took it to Frankfurt Book Fair, and I'd never had a book go to Frankfurt. And then they came back, and I thought they would say, yeah, we managed to sell it in Denmark, or we'd managed to sell in Upper Volta a copy. And they come back, and they say, yeah, we've sold it in 36 countries, 30 translation rights. And I'm just going, what? So the shocks just kept coming. And then 3 weeks ago, the final shock was when they called me up and said, yeah, Paramount Pictures wants to buy your book, and would you be amenable to that? And I said, if they option the book and write the script and then release the film, then actually it will add up to a lot of money.
That'll be amazing. Well, a joyous story to hear for somebody who's been, you know, chipping away at the block for so long. Let's touch on some of the themes that I think that are really important in the book.
Sure.
Not least of which is this woman, Rachel, who's the mother whose daughter, Kylie, is kidnapped. She is every woman.
Yeah.
She is the most ordinary and extraordinary mother in the world. This is a woman who never in her wildest dreams would think of kidnapping another child or putting any other child into any harm's way. So what you're looking at here is what happens, I suppose, when you take the law into your own hands, when you kind of become a vigilante, and the kind of moral decisions you have to make.
Yeah, I really wanted to take Rachel on this really complicated ethical and moral journey. She's a philosopher, and I knew that she would have studied all these different philosophical systems. And every philosophical system I'm aware of, you know, in
You studied philosophy.
Yeah, I studied philosophy as well. And in Aristotelian philosophy, in utilitarian philosophy, in Kantian ethics, Rachel does the wrong thing in every single one. To take someone else's child to get your child released is absolutely the wrong thing to do. But it's my hope that readers will still follow her on that ethical and moral journey. And while maybe not forgiving her, at least will understand her. And then they'll maybe ask themselves, well, what would I have done in her place?
And you mentioned all those different philosophers in the midst of all that. As I said, you studied philosophy in Oxford, wasn't it? Was that postgraduate study?
That was postgraduate. Yeah. I did 3 years of...
And a full scholarship as well. So you were clearly... in the philosophy world.
I really enjoyed it. I particularly enjoyed just moral and ethical philosophy. I found that strangely very exciting.
And how has that? Do you think that has fed directly into the writing? I mean, in this book, in the chain, it's very overt mm-hmm. at times. You know, you mentioned specific philosophers because Rachel can do that because she's a philosopher herself. Was it important for you to get that in there? You know,
yeah, it was a wee bit cheeky, but I always wanted to have in the internal dynamics of a novel sort of this internal philosophical debate, and maybe Camus debating with Schopenhauer, who's debating with...
Which happens.
Yeah, which happens.
In a crime thriller.
Yeah, and I really wanted to have... it's really fun for me to have a text and then to have a subtext and then sometimes to have a sub-subtext operating beneath the level. So if you just want to see it as an ordinary crime thriller, that's completely fine. But if you want to look a little bit deeper, you'll find that there's other stuff in the book as well.
So when I'm sure you've heard Colm Tobin's comments about genre writing and specifically about crime thrillers.
Yeah.
When you hear that and you describe what you've just described to me about text, subtext and sub-subtext, trying to get philosophy in there all along and to do so in the way that you've done, what's your reaction?
Well, it would be like somebody from America saying, oh, I don't like Irish novels because I picked up this Maeve Binchy book and it was all about girls on bicycles in Dublin in the 50s, and that's not really my cup of tea. And then saying, so I'm not going to read any more books from Ireland. So Colm clearly read one crime novel, which was, you know, poorly written or sloppily constructed, and then decided, oh, this entire genre... where there's 5,000 or 6,000 working writers in the genre producing high, low, medium, noir fiction of every level is not worth considering. And the person I feel sorry for is Colm Tobin, to be honest, because he's closing himself off to this incredibly diverse body of literature. It's like me saying I don't like science fiction and like just closing myself off to this amazingly complicated world. And so I just feel sorry for him, to be honest.
And I'm sure you could give us 25 readers or writers he could read if you wanted to send him in that direction. But what do you think about the kind of online reaction to that then? He did express a personal opinion, it's not to my taste, whatever he said subsequent to that, but then there's this backlash on
the backlash isn't good either. I mean, no one should be, I think when you get to the age of about 16, you should just read whatever you want, and you should have your own reasons for reading what you want, and if there's things you don't want to read, nobody should be forced to read those things. If you want to read Thomas Hardy for the rest of your life, read Thomas Hardy. If all you want to do, I remember there was one famous, I can't remember who it was, but I remember there was this famous scientist, might have been Bertrand Russell, and they said to him, do you ever read fiction at all? And he says, oh yes, all six every year. And the guy says, what's all six? All six Jane Austen. And that's all he read. He just read the six Jane Austen novels every year, starting in January 1st, and then that was his fiction. And to me, that's completely fine. If that's what you want to do, then that's what you should do.
Well, though, I presume you'd be much happier to hear people that saying that they're going to read all of Adrian McKenty.
Oh, well, you can't go wrong there.
The Chain is the current novel from Adrian McKenty. I presume there's lots more to come.
Well, now that I've given up my dangerous Uber driving days for the sake of the general public, as health and getting out there on their journeys, I guess I'm going back to full-time writing, and I'll have another book coming down the pike.
I'm sure a lot of people will echo my sentiments when they say, good to have you back. Adrian McKenty, his new book, The Chain, is published by Orion.